77 WABC.
This portion of Religion Online is brought to you by Calvary Hospital.
And now, the longest-running program in the history of 77 WABC, Religion on the Line with Rabbi Joseph Potasnik.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to Religion on the Line. I am Rabbi Potasnik, and tonight we begin the Festival of Hanukkah. So let me apologize to all of you who are sitting in traffic in New York. You know, it's all that Hanukkah traffic around Rockefeller Center, all those menorahs being sold on the sidewalks. No, you know, that's not the case. But it is a beautiful time of year. I will always remember the first Hanukkah after 9/11. I was at the site, which we call, some call Ground Zero, and the Christmas tree arrived, very tall Christmas tree. Then a menorah, or Chanukiah, as we call it, arrived, which wasn't as tall as the Christmas tree. A group of carpenters, all of whom happened to be Christian, saw the disparity in height, and they volunteered on their own time to build a platform so that Hanukkah and Christmas, in terms of height, would be of the same size. That, to me, was a very defining moment in terms of our respect for one another and our different traditions. Obviously, Hanukkah and Christmas are different. They share some commonality, you know, in terms of the lights, but there are some significant differences. But I thought that the message that year, especially after 9/11, was that we all need to be there for one another. We all need to increase light in the world. And we have to do what we can to protect one another. I was listening to Rabbi Jonathan Sacks, who was former chief rabbi of Great Britain, was knighted by the Queen, so it's his lordship, Rabbi Sacks, who said that anti-Semitism is also a responsibility of Christians and protecting Jews, just as anti-Christianity or anti-Islam would be a responsibility for us to stand for others. And I have to say that here in New York, we have fulfilled that responsibility because we really share some close relationships. So when there is any kind of victimization of the other, we are there for one another. It is common now for Jews, Christians, and Muslims to stand together at the respective sacred sites that belong to our different communities. I've been to many mosques, many churches when there's an act of desecration, and I can tell you that whenever there's any action taken against a Jewish house of worship, we also have a response from Christian and Muslim communities. Proof of that was following Pittsburgh, of course, when that outpouring of true respect was so manifest in our city. It was a heartening moment. It was triumph followed by tragedy. And if those who terrorize us think that they're going to separate us, they are totally wrong. They really brought us closer to one another. So Hanukkah may be a minor holiday in our tradition, but it has a major message, the message of let's bring more light into the world for ourselves and for one another. You are listening to Religion on the Line, and this portion is brought to you by Calvary Hospital.
77 WABC. Rabbi Joseph Potasnik, celebrating 35 years of Religion on the Line on 77 WABC.
Religion Online is brought to you by Sherman's Flatbush Memorial Chapel. Visit them online at shermanschapel.com. One of the nicest things about being a rabbi is you get to meet some special people, one of them being former police commissioner Raymond Kelly. And I have to say that I've come to know him and admire him. I admired him years ago from afar, but as we got to know each other, I really got to appreciate the real core of conviction that he possesses. And there was an article that appeared in the New York Post entitled How to Find Hate, How to Fight Hate. You can find it easily, but how to fight it is another story. So it's a great honor to go to the conference line and speak with Commissioner Ray Kelly. Hi, Commissioner. How are you?
Rabbi, great to be with you. Thank you for those kind remarks.
Well, you certainly deserve them. You have a resume that's most impressive, and all of us who were privileged to work with you saw leadership at its best. So thank you for all you did, not just for the Jewish community, but for all communities. I think in order to be an effective police commissioner, you have to see all people as equals. I just mentioned that with Hanukkah, Christmas, that, you know, we stand together, we have different celebrations, different rituals, but ultimately we are connected to one another. We have the same roots. So,
very true.
Yeah. So you did a study You were involved, I think, with the World Jewish Congress, and you were commissioned to do a study, I think, of anti-Semitism in Europe. And what did you find, and were your findings shocking to you?
Well, first, the prime mover behind our endeavor was Ronald Lauder. Mr. Lauder is well-known in New York and throughout the world, certainly by the Jewish community. He's the president of the World Jewish Congress. And he asked myself and my group, which consists of David Cohen, a former intelligence commissioner of NYPD, and Mitchell Silva, who was in charge of intelligence analysis, the NYPD, to take a look at the rising anti-Semitism in Europe, to visit certain countries there, to give him an assessment of what's going on, and to make recommendations about improving the security of the Jewish diaspora. I mean, we've been in policing a long time, so you can know a little bit about security, and he wanted us to make those recommendations, if possible. It may not be possible in certain countries. So we embarked on that study. We visited the UK, Belgium, France on several occasions, Germany, Hungary, Austria, and we just came back from the Ukraine. And no surprise, anti-Semitism is deeply ingrained in throughout Europe. Each country is manifested differently, but it clearly is an issue that is of growing concern to the Jewish community in Europe, and obviously in the United States as well. The horrific events of that happened in Pittsburgh at the synagogue, the Tree of Life synagogue, where 11 people were killed, happened when we were in Kiev in the Ukraine. And it showed that, of course, that the danger, the threat of anti-Semitism is everywhere. We're not immune from it in this country by any means, but I think we may have taken our eye off the ball a little bit as far as that is concerned. And I think law enforcement has to be much more engaged in protecting all minorities, but certainly the Jewish community in the United States.
Commissioner, we have not found a cure for this virus we call anti-Semitism, and I'm sure you read what happened at Columbia, where a professor's office, a professor who teaches Holocaust studies, the office was vandalized and swastikas were put on the wall inside the office, and the word Yid, meaning Jew, was sprayed on the wall. And this is at Columbia University. We're not talking about some remote area, some forlorn area. We're talking right here in New York City. And not to mention what goes on. There's the daughter of Ambassador Danny Dayan. She was on the program. She talks about, it takes real courage today to be a student at one of these universities. We're talking here about Columbia. And to be pro-Israel.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Many of these campuses are hotbeds for the DBS movement, which is the anti-Zionist movement, urging boycotting, disinvestment, and sanctions against Israel. But those protests, and certainly in this country you can have those protests, often sort of bleed into anti-Semitism. Mm-hmm. They say that it's anti-Israeli policy, and fine, you can have an opinion on that, strong opinion, but in its manifestation, it very quickly gets into anti-Semitism in a very vitriolic way. We saw that in our travels in Europe. So it is certainly alive and well, unfortunately. And what we're urging in our article is that Jewish institutions have to think security. And they've been doing it much less so here than in Europe. We found that Europeans are, they feel that they were at greater risk, and Pittsburgh proved that the great risk here as well. So we are urging that every Jewish institution has a comprehensive security plan, that they practice active shooter drills, that they have the appropriate locks and alarms. And what we saw in Europe is that the entry points to synagogues and religious schools are much more tightly controlled than they are here. And obviously, that's one of the things that we want security people and people in these institutions to take a very, very hard look at. We also saw much more volunteerism, where the Jewish community is coming together in, to offer their services for free. The whole tradition of volunteerism throughout America has sort of waned. You know, we were much more involved 20, 30, 40 years ago than we are now. We think that should be resurrected. And also, they need a much closer relationship with the police. Thankfully, in New York City, the police and the Jewish community are very closely tied together. You'll see police resources on Shabbos. You'll see them at major holy days. That doesn't necessarily occur in other cities in the United States. But the religious community, I think, has to reach out to the police. It's a two-way street. You need that support. You need them to sort of be familiar with each other, know each other, be able to the community be able to reach out to the police when there's times of need.
Commissioner, the other day I was listening to the former chief rabbi of Britain, Jonathan Sacks, and he mentioned what you just said in terms of the volunteerism, that this reassuring presence of volunteers in synagogues in Europe. It means so much because they're familiar faces, and when they learn, you know, various techniques, you know, it's another layer of security, but it doesn't eliminate the need, as you indicate, to work with the professionals.
And we met with Rabbi Sacks when we were in the UK, and I know Ronald Lauder, again, the president of the World Jewish Congress, is very much a proponent of volunteerism, and that's one of the things that we want to do, particularly as we put our focus back on Europe, is to support that volunteerism, give them perhaps some additional resources to have more chapters, to do a better job of recruiting, to give the volunteers equipment that they need to protect themselves and protect the religious institution.
One of the things Rabbi Sacks said, and we do it here in New York, he said, look, anti-Semitism has to become a Christian issue as well. If we're going to fight, we need the support of other faith communities. Here in New York, we have that. You know, it's so hard. And you have a Cardinal Dolan, who staunchly stands up for the rights of others and speaks loudly when there's an attack, for example, on a Jewish synagogue or some Jewish sacred site. But we need to see that in Europe as well. I know there are meetings that take place, there's dialogue, but there needs to be a strong religious response, like first responders religiously standing up and saying, this is an attack on us as it is an attack on every faith community.
Yeah, and Cardinal Dolan, I briefed him on what we had done in Europe and what we think should be done here, and he was very, very receptive. And obviously, it's just not Jewish institutions that are at risk. I think, unfortunately, in this day and age, all religions have to think about protecting themselves. If you remember, just a few months ago, we had the terrible attack on the Baptist Church in Texas, where 26 people were killed. A few years ago, we had an attack on a Sikh temple. I think it was in Wisconsin or Minnesota, where several people were killed. So it is a sad reality that religious institutions have to think a lot more about security than they've done in the past.
So what happens now? I was talking to a group that was traveling to Germany and others who were going to England. They're being told by security it would be better for you not to wear a yarmulke publicly. I think you mentioned last time you were on the air that you wore a yarmulke. Right, somebody named Kelly wore a yarmulke in one of the areas just to get a sense of what was transpiring there. But they're being told, I think I read a report that in England, take the mezuzahs off the doorpost. You can't have indicia of being Jewish. I mean, how sad is this? You know, we talk about Holocaust remembrance, and here we are telling people, remove any, you know, Jewish identity from the public sphere.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. We did wear kippahs or yarmulkes on the streets in Paris, but that clearly is the information, the direction that Jewish men get in France. It's called camouflage aliyah. Aliyah means, you know, going back to Israel, but it's a way of staying where you are and not showing your Jewishness, and that's a sad commentary. So you'll see young men, maybe they wear baseball caps instead of it, but it is very difficult to be a practicing Jew in many places in Europe, but unfortunately in France, very much so.
I just came back from Abu Dhabi. There was a World Conference of Faith Leaders talking about child dignity in the digital age and how technology, while it can do some great things, it can also facilitate some horrible things. And you have young people who are compromising their very existence by revealing information online. So, you know, you have hate mongers who are spreading the virus online, and people who are receiving it, and people who are looking for it. So, you know, we need to do a better job in terms of monitoring it. I know ADL has a department that monitors, you know, cyber hatred, but all of us need to be more sophisticated in what goes on so we can be more protective.
Yeah. Now, the ADL does a great job in that regard, but the number of anti-Semitic threats and taunts on the internet has gone up almost geometrically, in certainly in Europe. Now, in European countries, hate speech is against the law, but tracking down the source of where these things come from is no easy task. But they're way up. These types of inflammatory anti-Semitic comments are really all over the internet in Europe, and there's not much that's being done to address it. And quite frankly, it's very difficult to address it.
You know, it's so disheartening that here we are talking about anti-Semitism again. You know, many of us thought that we'd reach a day when we talk about freedom and everybody enjoying, you know, their respective traditions openly without any kind of fear. But we're not at that point. I don't know if we'll ever be at that point, but obviously what you're saying is that we need to do as much as possible to protect ourselves. We have to pray in God, but we also have to protect one another.
And that's what we want to see. We want to see action taken. Yes, we can talk about it. We can do surveys, but we want to see the manifestation of security measures, volunteerism, those sorts of things to better safeguard certainly the Jewish community, but I think it has to be an issue for other religions as well. Yeah, I mean, anti-Semitism has been around for thousands of years.
Yeah.
It's unfortunately, it's with us, and it's going to be with us to stay. So what we're looking to do is just make the Jewish community just a little bit safer by taking some of these actions.
Isn't it somewhat frightening how the right sees you as a threat in terms of being a Jew, the left sees you as a threat in terms of being a Jew? No matter which way you turn, those extremes want to extinguish you. I remember years ago, you know, reading how they used to make fun of Jews because they didn't have a homeland. Oh, you're a nomadic people. Now you have a homeland, now you shouldn't have a homeland. You know, it's
correct. And you can't win.
You can't win. And I tell you, there are people who try to spend all this time looking at the causes. And at the end of the day, what difference does it make? Because they hate you or hate us for who we are. So no matter what the cause, we're not going to change our identity. We're not going to do something to accommodate, you know, their particular desire. We're going to be who we are. They're going to hate us for whatever the reason. Doesn't matter what the reason is.
Yeah. It's a sad reality. You're absolutely right.
Commissioner, once again, thank you. Thank you for all you have done, all you do, and will continue to do. We're blessed to have someone like yourself who's always ready. I mean, you're always there for people. I've been with you at so many events. I've been with you in many churches. I've seen you at St. Pat's many, many times. And everyone always comes over and wants to take a picture with you, wants to, you know, shake your hand or hug you. And it's a way of saying thank you. Because not that you seek, you know, all those plaudits, but it's nice to hear it. Nice to know the people are grateful for all that you have done for them and are doing for
them.
Well,
I, I very much appreciate that, Rabbi, and very much appreciate anybody coming over and thanking me.
You mean they remember you?
I still see myself as representative of the department. The cops are doing just a terrific job in this city, and I'm sure it will continue.
All right. Commissioner, Ray.
Rabbi, thanks, pal. Great to be with you.
Raymond W. Kelly. Read the article, How to Fight Hate. Thanks so much. Have a great day.
77 WABC. Rabbi Joseph Potasnik, celebrating 35 years of religion on the line on 77 WABC.
This portion is brought to you by Calvary Hospital. Welcome back, Religion Online. I'm Rabbi Potasnik, and I am privileged to have on the conference line someone whom I consider to be a brother, colleague, friend, but really a brother. And I am a great admirer of Rabbi Lester Bronstein, who is the spiritual leader of Beit Am Shalom in White Plains. He's the president of the New York Board of Rabbis. He's there for all people. And if you go to his congregation, I recommend you do on a Sabbath. You will find he has a congregation that is filled with many who come there just to be with him and with his wife, Cantor Benji Schiller. So it's a great couple, a great synagogue, great congregation. You should go there. Welcome, Rabbi Bronstein.
Thank you. You are a sweetheart to give me all those beautiful words.
Well, and I mean them. I mean, sometimes, you know, you sit there and you listen to introductions, you say, does he really expect me to believe what he's saying? But in this case, it's all true. As a matter of fact, it's an understatement of all.
That's why we want to, yeah, it's right. So we joke in the rabbinate. So it shouldn't be a joke, but we conduct a funeral and, you know, we want to make sure when people come in and say, who the heck is the rabbi talking? You know,
am I in the right room?
Yeah. Am I in the right room? This is, you know, I don't remember all of those charitable acts and this and the other, but, you know, but that's not true. I do appreciate that comment.
Ben-Gurion was the first prime minister of Israel, said years ago, the difference between hearing your eulogy when you're living and later on when you're not is that in the first instance, there's one person in the room who believes it. You know, so you know, sometimes you hear these things and you want to believe it anyway.
But if your listeners keep believing what you say about me, especially about my wife, then at least they'll give me a few minutes to say a few words.
Well, anyway, so here we are.
Yeah.
Approaching Hanukkah, which I have to say, it receives probably more attention than some of the other more major holidays.
Right.
You know, you talk about Shavuot to people, and they look at you, oh, okay, I think I know what you're talking about.
It happens
near the summer. But Hanukkah, people clearly understand what it is. There was an article I just read recently where someone said, look, Hanukkah is nice, but it's not Christmas. We shouldn't conflate them. Obviously, it's because of Christmas, I think, that Hanukkah receives heightened attention. But it's still it's a minor holiday with a major message.
Let's talk
about, you know, what transpired years ago, the story of the Maccabees, where Syrian Greeks sought to eradicate Jewish life.
That was the leftovers, one third of Alexander the Great's Middle Eastern empire. Ptolemies, how you say it, and, you know, Egypt was another, and there's the Seleucids run out of Assyria, and in their catchment included the land of Israel. So the Jews were subject for a while to Alexander the Great, but now what was left of his empire. These Seleucids, we call them the Greeks sometimes, but they're Greeks, but they're Greek Assyrians, really.
Yeah.
And they had a particularly tyrannical ruler, Antiochus the Fourth. Which one was he? Antiochus the Terrible, Antiochus the Great, who declared the practice of Judaism to be, or at least most of the key practices of Judaism, Sabbath observance, circumcision, maybe Torah teaching, to be outlawed. And then, of course, he took over the Holy Temple and the Temple Mount and made it into a Greek temple. And that sense, of course, desecrated it. And so a group of Jews fought back. Most Jews didn't fight back. This is all part of the history. Most of the Jews didn't fight back. Some of them because, they didn't, you know, okay, you know, we'll live with it. And others Jews because maybe they actually appreciated their new status as maybe as Greeks. They were willing to sacrifice their own Jewish identity. But a stalwart group fought back, and they, and at least initially they got a lot of support. These Maccabees, as they're called, was a group really of priests who lived in Modi'in, just up the road from Jerusalem. And they got a lot of support, and the Jew, and they were able to wrest the temple back from these Assyrian Greeks and clean it up. And goes the legend, they were able to reestablish, the legend is that they had to relight the menorah, which was a kind of the, you know, the logo of the temple, and they had to have the appropriate amount of holy supervised oil, and there wasn't enough to run it for more than one day, but they lit it anyway, and then the miracle is it lasted for 8 days or nights. Whether the miracle happened or not, a lot of people say that the real miracle was that these Jews were willing to light the menorah, go forth knowing that they couldn't, that they didn't have enough to go on. In other words, they weren't hoping for a miracle that would last longer. They were just saying, we're going to do the best we can with what we've got. And that should be one of the great lessons of Hanukkah, that that spiritual faith and hope has to do with moving forward and going on with what you've got, you know, and not not hoping there'll be some kind of divine intervention. Divine intervention is nice, but we don't live by miracles. We live by our collective faith in our beliefs and our principles, and they did, and you know, and they cleaned it up. There's another little piece of the history that people some people know, but most people don't pay attention to. The reason Hanukkah is 8 days initially is not because of the one night of one cruise of oil lasted 8 nights, but because during that year when they regained the control of the temple from the Greeks, these the Jews were not able to celebrate the real major holiday of the biblical period, which was Sukkot or Sukkot, that which of course goes on for a full week. So the Hanukkah celebration, the rededication ceremony, and Hanukkah, of course, means dedication, the rededication of the temple was done over an eight-day period in order to be a kind of a mulligan, you know, a makeup for the Sukkot festival that was lost. And that's an interesting little historical note, and that's really why, you know, from in practical terms, it's 8 days
long. One of the things that you touched upon, which I think warrants, emphasis, is this idea of not succumbing to passive resignation. This idea that when, you know, a crisis comes, and in this case, you know, it was really tragic to see what was being done to the Jewish people, that there were those who said, we're not going to close our eyes. We're not going to give in.
Right.
We're going to fight back. And we talk much about.
We're going to be public about it.
Right. We talk about Pittsburgh, for example.
It
was a moment when, you know, how disheartening that here in America something like this could happen. And yet there were those Jews and non-Jews who came together and said, we're not going to let that shooting in a sanctuary be the final word.
Right. The final word's going to be our word, and it's going to be a great, joyous, public celebration of our religion and our various religions. We're going to stand together, one religion with another, you know, for that larger principle. I mean, that's a great Pittsburgh. The aftermath of Pittsburgh is a great American Hanukkah story.
That's
true. Because one of the important things the rabbis required us to do when we celebrate Hanukkah is to light the menorah, light the Hanukkiah, in a public place. I don't mean a public square, but to light it so that the people walking by in the street can see it through your window, or you put it outside your door, you know, so that people can see the light. They call it Pirsuma Denisa, publicizing the miracle, the miracle of Hanukkah. And what happened after Pittsburgh, and you know it, Rabbi Potasnik, you saw it, that the Muslims, Christians, Hindus, Buddha, people all showed up. They wanted to be seen publicly supporting us Jews in our hour of darkness, in our hour of need.
Yeah.
You know, it was like lighting a Hanukkah light against the dark. It's a great Hanukkah story. I mean, I think this year that's what people have to say during Hanukkah, is that we just had Hanukkah. It was Pittsburgh, and that people of all faiths stood up and lit a light together.
We, as you know, we at the New York Board of Rabbis are having a Hanukkah celebration that is recognizing the heroism of those in Pittsburgh. We're having a rabbi join us from Pittsburgh, Aaron Bisno. Mm-hmm. But we're also having members of the Pittsburgh Police. The chief of police is coming in.
So
one of the officers being recognized was grazed by a bullet when he entered the sanctuary to subdue the gunman. Someone else who entered the sanctuary, one of the police, has family who are members of Tree of Life. And it's important for us to say thank you. But here are individuals, Jewish and non-Jewish, who risk their lives.
Right.
Right? At
they
that
did
moment.
Risk their lives.
Yeah.
Right. That's, I'm telling you, Pittsburgh is horror, and is a horror, and the aftermath of it is one of the great American stories, the greatest stories about faith and religion in this country, you know?
Yeah.
Because
so,
these guys stood up. You know, you and I were, of course, there with at our senior colleague, Rabbi Schneier's congregation, when one of the ceremonies that happened after Pittsburgh.
Right.
Again, one of the great interfaith commemorations in the days after. And he had said that he himself was, a boy in Germany, and he stood there and watched on Kristallnacht on November 9th of 1938, watched his synagogue go up in flames and all of the Jewish stores and synagogues being flamed, and the police and fire stood standing there watching it happen.
Right.
And he says, the difference is, in Pittsburgh, these police and fire ran in, risked their lives.
Yeah.
Some of them
yeah.
severely injured
mm-hmm.
because we're fellow Americans, we're fellow human beings, and it is a
you know,
God willing, a different time.
I was talking to members of FDNY recently. I said, we in the Jewish community are so grateful to you for so many things, but one of the things that you do is you risk your lives to save Torahs. You'll rush into a synagogue, and I've seen this many times, and you see firefighters, many of whom are not Jewish, carrying the Torah from the sanctuary so that it doesn't get burned, doesn't get destroyed.
They did it here 15 years ago.
Yeah.
My shul had a big fire. It wasn't terrorism. It was an electrical fire, but it was scary. And these firefighters went in and said, well, we need to get your Torahs out. And we said, no, actually, don't risk anybody's life. They said, no, well, we got it, Rabbi. We're on it. And they came out with all our 6 Torah scrolls, and we read them regularly. And they were all saved by these firefighters.
Yeah.
They get it. They get the connection between their job and the great religious message. It's not a message from any one religion. I mean, I promote the Jewish religion, but they're all of these religions stand for something much bigger. It's the great human.
So let me understand. We talked about the right. Hanukkah celebrates the right to celebrate your faith tradition without interference from others. And yet there are those who want to try to bring the two together, Hanukkah and Christmas, and we've seen Chrismukka and all variations of that. And it's really contrary to the message. These are separate holidays. They can be respected by the other, but they don't have to be made into one holiday.
Yeah, I feel for a Jewish kid who's maybe not a kid who lives in a totally Jewish, Orthodox, observant environment, a kid who goes to public school and whatever, who feels left out,
Right.
I mean, I remember being that kid, and my parents said, no, we're Jews. That's their holiday. We don't do that. And I said, okay, and I would like.
And we did better. We got 8 gifts. They only got 1. We got 8.
but the one up, we got 8 gifts. They got 1. I mean, but that's kind of nonsense. By the way, some kids were saying to me, we have, we're in the chorus there, and they throw in a Hanukkah song, and how come the Hanukkah songs aren't as good as the Christmas songs? They said, because it's a minor, for us, it's a Hanukkah minor holiday.
Right.
If you want to compare songs to songs, look at our Rosh Hashanah song, look at our Passover song.
Yeah.
We have fantastic Passover music.
Yeah.
We have some of the most magnificent religious music in the world that we have for Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, which are our equivalent. If you're going to say equivalent, they're equivalent to Christmas.
I remember when I was in high school and there were Christmas songs being sung, and somebody said, well, why don't the Jewish kids sing the Christmas songs? And I remember saying, because Christmas songs deal with the theology of Christianity.
Yeah, they do.
Hanukkah songs about the history of Hanukkah. Everyone can share in the Hanukkah story and sing the Hanukkah song.
Right.
It's not in any way a definition of right. the essence of the religion. Whereas yeah. Christmas, right. you know, this is the very, you know, the roots.
I love those Christians, yeah. those Christmas songs, and I think that the theology behind Christmas for Christians is a beautiful and powerful message. Look, you know, the Savior is born and the light to the world, and it's a certain way it's a like the Hanukkah story that because the lighting of lights and trees and all this to publicize
right.
what for Christians is a miracle. It's not we don't share the theology of that miracle, so for us it's not really appropriate for us to be, you know, singing those songs and doing those things, but we celebrate for our Christian neighbors, not with them, but for them. That makes it sense.
I mean, one of the most inspiring sights for me
yeah.
is you drive down any street of New York mm-hmm. during this Hanukkah Christmas period, and you look around, and you'll see Christmas trees, right? You can look into, and you'll see Hanukkah menorahs nearby. And people are celebrating separate traditions, but celebrating as Americans.
We have now the Kwanzaa tradition, too. Some people
yeah.
do, you know. Yeah, it's wonderful to see people supporting one another's tradition without just doing it, you know, without
yeah.
adapting.
It's a lesson. It's a lesson for young people that you can be different and still respect the other, even if the other is the dominant religion. You don't have to feel that you're excluded, that you're a pariah. You're an equal.
We are all equals.
Yeah.
You know, and that's, well, look, I mean, that's the secret of the American message. When the American message works, which it doesn't always, but when it always works, it's that people aren't allowed to fully, publicly, joyously celebrate their own tradition and support others in doing the same without having to conform or comply with somebody else.
And that's why when there are those who want to extinguish the lights,
yeah.
as we've seen on campuses, Columbia and other places,
yeah,
when we see a professor, you know, at the UN say horrendous things,
yeah.
Seeking to not have a Jewish state of Israel, there's no room for a Jewish state, then people stand up together and say, no, you're not going to get away with that.
Yeah, it's disgraceful.
Yeah. So, you know, we're different and we're the same simultaneously. Rabbi Lester,
it's not that hard. Wait, one second. It's yeah. not that hard to hold those two truths in your mind if you realize that they're not contradictory.
Right.
That we're different, and in that way, we're the same. Okay, I messed up your.
Not at all. Not
I just think
at all.
Just
Listen,
such an important
do we
thing.
Can get two rabbis to confine their comments to about 16, 17 minutes?
Mm-hmm.
That's a miracle, also. Maybe one of the extended miracles of Hanukkah.
Amen.
Yeah. So thank you. Look, Rabbi Les Bronstein, yeah. always a pleasure. I work with you. I learned from you, and today was great listening to you, and I look forward to many more years together. But thank you for all you do,
not just
for the Jewish community, but you're there for all communities because you're really you're a proud Jew, a proud American, and you bring it all together.
All right, thank you, my friend.
Thanks so much.
Bye-bye.
77 WABC. Rabbi Joseph Potasnik, celebrating 35 years of Religion on the Line on 77 WABC.
This is Rabbi Potasnik as we conclude the program and we're going to commence the celebration of Hanukkah. I want to say that someone came to see me this past week and with an organization called Sharing Seats. It's an organization based on volunteerism. People who are ready to take people, other people who are facing difficult times, to an experience, to a game, an athletic game, to a Broadway show, and people donate tickets. Nobody gets anything from it. You may get a tax deduction if you donate the seats, but no one's paid. It's all done as a mitzvah. It's all done as a meritorious deed to just bring a little bit of light into the lives of people who face some difficult and dark times. To me, that's the whole message of Hanukkah, and I would extend it to other holidays as well, of Christmas, Kwanzaa, of people who simply are there as volunteers because they want to make your life a little bit better. We all have bitterness in our lives, but it's nice that there are people who want to make it better. There's a statement in Jewish tradition that it's a great mitzvah, it's a great deed to bring light into the world. To me, that's the essential message of Hanukkah, and I would say it's also the message of Christmas, that all of us have a responsibility because of our love for our faith, because of our loyalty to our tradition, to say we need to do as much as we can to brighten the world for those who are hurting deeply. If all of us will do that with one another, for one another, I think we will see a much better place which we can live together, especially standing together against those who seek to hurt us, and so those who seek to remove us from this world. So we are many, but we are also one. I wish you all a happy, healthy Hanukkah, and we'll talk about other faith traditions in the weeks ahead. This is Rabbi Joe Spetasnik. You'll be listening to Religion on the Line.
77 WABC.